Accession number 12910, Reel 15.
Then Reel 15.
Thank you. I was saying that the proximity of this general police unit, based around us by the commissioner, did have an excellent effect, and one felt very much more secure from the general angle of possible trials and tribulations, troubles.
What year are we talking about when we speak about the flotilla of the Royal Navy and the disorder?
Probably around 55, 56. I can't remember, really. The only other thing I think of note, I believe of note, during my tenure of the Coast Province, which I thoroughly enjoyed, was a royal visit. We had two royal visits. And this was right at the end of my time. This was, this must have been 1957. We were told some 3-4 months beforehand that Princess Margaret would visit Kenya, and that she would start her visit to Kenya with the Coast Province, and that she would arrive at a particular time by air from Britain, and that she would spend probably 2 to 3 days with us, and that she would then embark on board Britannia, the yacht Britannia, and would go down to Mauritius, where she would go through various ceremonials, and then across to Dar es Salaam and carry out a series of functions in Tanganyika, finally finishing up in the highlands of Kenya, based on Nairobi. And this, in fact, is what happened. This information was given to me some 3 to 4 months before the princess arrived. We were visited by somebody, or two people, from out from England, who had access to royal circles, and their purpose was to find out how we proposed to cope with security, and we were told various things the princess liked and didn't like, how it was hoped we would, the kind of speeds at various points of the princess's progress were required. For instance, in a built-up area, we would be down to 3 miles, 2.5 miles to 3 miles an hour in the vehicles, the princess's carriage. In less built-up area, less congested areas, where she was going from point A to point B, but where people might be expected to be along the line a bit, we would be perhaps at 20 miles an hour, that kind of thing. The general tenor of the whole thing was that it was hoped that as many people as possible would be allowed to see the princess as near as was wise. So that's how we based our planning. I handed over to my deputy the normal running of police affairs, and I concentrated to a large extent for these 3 months on planning. And it was a big area because although Mombasa itself is not particularly large, we had to arrange for the princess to get from the airport at a place called Port Reitz, which is about 10 miles, 10 or 14 miles outside Mombasa, Her security had to be paramount from there into Mombasa, and of course all the time this business of security was paramount. Nothing must be allowed to interfere with the princess's safety. So the whole time we were thinking of that, and I formed a little planning group. Indeed, I'm in touch now with my staff officer of that particular time, a man called Benson, Ron Benson. He's now living in South Africa, and I had a card from him the other day. He it was who actually did the logistics of the various security forces that we put into play. It was quite intricate and complicated. We produced eventually, as it were, an order of battle, a security memorandum. And good things the commissioner ever said to me, my new commissioner, a man called Sir Richard Catling, ever said to me, well, he did congratulate me on the success of our security arrangements for the princess. And it all worked extraordinarily well. She arrived, met by Sir Evelyn Baring, and introduced to some of us up at the airport. Our security operation went into being, and things worked quite remarkably well for the 2 days that she was there with us.
What were you told about what she liked and disliked?
Do you know, I can't remember. I know there were one or two little things that she particularly disliked. I can't remember them, I'm afraid. I know that we did provide against one or two things. I think she didn't like being quizzed too closely. She was very gracious. I was behind her for those 2 days all the way. I was able, she spoke to me on several occasions, and I have reason to believe she thoroughly enjoyed her visit to us. I was congratulated not only by the commissioner and by the governor, but by several other people with her at the time. And I must say, it was one of the success stories of my whole police career.
So that was in your last year at Mombasa, was it? 57?
Just before in my last months.
Where did you go to after Mombasa?
I retired. I retired very early.
Could I ask you one or two things about the individuals you've mentioned,
yes.
Like Sir Evelyn Baring?
Yes.
What kind of a chap was he?
To look at, he was tall, and I suppose when I knew him, he was probably a man of 50-odd. Tall, spare, very charming, not voluble. He liked to, he was always, he had a wonderful sense of humour. He liked people to talk to him. In fact, whenever he came down, I was always, well, I suppose I can, it must have been 3-4 occasions that I can remember this happening. And the provincial commissioner of the coast, a man called Desmond O'Hagan, I don't think he was awfully fond of it, because Sir Evelyn used to say, right, sit down over there and now talk to me. Tell me what's going on here. Tell me everything that's on your mind. And I used to. And he was very charming, delightful. He used to, I think he his style was always to get people to talk to him rather than have too much come to him through official channels. And that's what, of course, the provincial commissioner didn't like. But
Why should he have disliked that?
He was rather a stilted sort of man, O'Hagan. He liked everything to be according to the book. according to official channels and so on. He would have liked everything that I said to the governor to have gone through him first, that sort of thing. He was a nice enough chap, a bit pompous, a bit pompous. I believe he's still alive, so I hope this is what I'm saying. However, he was all right. He was all right. He did his job. Perhaps he was sometimes a slight figure of fun through over-pomposity, but he did his job, and he was married to a most delightful person, and I think she kept him within bounds. But I don't think he liked his policeman, whom I was, senior policeman, whom I was, sitting down talking to the governor as man to man. But this was not from my prompting, it was the governor's prompting. So and, of course, I obeyed him.
He didn't like informal methods?
No.
I'm interested in the Ian Henderson and Bernard Ruck. Can you tell me more about the contact you had with them and how it took place?
Well, Ian Henderson was posted up to me to try to find out as much as possible what was going on in the Nehru reserves. He channeled with... He kept me informed as best he could of what was happening, and he had direct access to the special branch in Nairobi. He was a very young man. I'd known him a little when I first got to Nairobi because he was the son-in-law of my landlady in the house where I lodged. And I had met Ian quite a bit. He was a very, very nice young man. And as I've said earlier, he was born and bred in Kenya, had gone to school in Kenya, and had been brought up among the Kikuyu, whose language he spoke fluently. He was able to go into the reserves, and he would have had the kind of contact that probably nobody else in Kenya at that time had, because simply of his early bringing up among the Kikuyu. I'm not sure that I'm right. I believe he got a George Medal. Whether it was a George Medal or George, it must have been a George Medal. Bernard Ruck got a George Medal. Whether Ian Henderson got a cross or not, I don't know. But in the later stages of the Mau Mau, they both took their lives into their hands by going into the forest and searching out the gangs in order to get a rapprochement with the gangs. They were both very brave men. Bernard Ruck, I had in charge of Nanyuki Police Station. And I was with him for 5 days on a very personal basis because with another man, the three of us went up the mountain, we went right up to the foot of Lenana Point, up to the glacier, right through the rainforest, up through the bamboos, up onto the moorland, up into the snow line, and for 5 days we were together. So I got to know Bernard Ruck quite well.
How did he compare with Ian Henderson?
Well, he wasn't in quite the same class as Ian Henderson, because he also was a Kenya boy, and he spoke Kikuyu, but he wasn't in quite the same standard of knowledge and closeness to the Kikuyu was Ian Henderson. He was a much more reserved man than Bernard Ruck was much more reserved than Ian Henderson. Ian Henderson was outgoing, charming, delightful, always a smile on his face. Bernard Ruck was rather more taciturn and rather more reserved and not quite so outgoing. I'm not saying he was sullen in any way. He and I got on extraordinarily well. I liked him. I think we got on. But he was his face was far less open and sort of outgoing than Ian's. Ian wrote a book. I can't remember what it was called, but it had quite a wide circulation. Whether it's still in publication, I don't know. I never read it, because I was by that time I couldn't get hold of it.
What exactly do you mean when you say he was brought up among the Kikuyu?
I believe, I'm not absolutely sure what I mean by that, except that he had, I believe he was brought up as a boy, rubbing shoulders with Kikuyu children, that sort of thing. I'm not absolutely sure, but what I do mean by that. But I always understood that his whole early life had been spent among Kikuyus, running around and talking as kids will, in that sort of way.
But as far as you were concerned, his job was to give you intelligence about earth training.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why, of course, his life would have been in danger. Had he, to what extent I don't know whether he was a blood brother of the Kikuyus, to what extent his brotherhood with the Kikuyus would have stood him, I don't know. I think he must have gone into very considerable danger indeed when he went into the forest, as indeed did Bernard Rock.
Were the Kikuyu able?
Sorry?
Were the Kikuyu people able?
Oh, yes, they were. They were regarded in Kenya as, without a shadow of doubt, the most able tribe of any of them in Kenya. Highly intelligent. Very highly intelligent. I think I'd like to mention, as we're trying to cover as much ground as possible, I'd like to mention two Europeans. One was a man called Wright, who was in, I think he was in scholastic circles, in education circles. I think his name was Wright. I'm not absolutely sure, but he comes to me as a man called Wright. I never met this man, if that really was his name, but he was a man who shunned European society and went straight, as near as he could, into African society, which meant Kikuyus. How long he'd been in Kenya, I don't know. To me, he was a shadowy figure, and I only heard about him. Eventually, I believe, got into a highly nervous condition after the Mau Mau started. And it was believed of him that he was feeding the Mau Mau with information about the security forces. Whether that is correct or not, I have no idea. But this shadowy figure was eventually hauled up in front of, I believe, the governor, and I think he was eased out of Kenya. I have an idea that he'd come from India. He was an Englishman, and I think what happened to him after that, I don't know. I have no idea at all. He was a sort of, to me, he was a sort of shadowy figure whom I never met at all. That is one of these two Europeans that I said that I wish to speak about. The other one was a completely different character altogether. He was a man called Commander Miller, Now, Miller, once again, to some extent, though not to the same extent as this man Wright, if that indeed was his name, I think it was, I'm not sure. Miller, to a lesser extent than Wright, also got the jitters because he also had been in educational circles and had tried to, in fact, he'd got himself into among the inner cabal of the Mau Mau. To what extent, really, he was listened to, I don't know. Be that as it may, Miller, I may say, had a George Cross. He'd been in the Navy during the war, and he got his George Cross through defusing a bomb somewhere, or a mine somewhere. The story of that I don't really know very much about. All I really can say about Miller is that after I got down to Mombasa, with Mau Mau blossoming, I was introduced to Miller somewhere, and we met in the ordinary way. I didn't then know much about him. But the then provincial commissioner got me along to his office. It wasn't the man I'm just talking about, Desmond O'Hagan. It was a previous man to him. He got me along to his office and he said, look, he said, I want to tell you something about Miller. He said he's been transferred down here to the education, by the education people, because he was getting too close to Mau Mau affairs up in the Highlands. Miller, he said, is in a pretty nervous condition. His nerve has been shaken quite a lot, and it was considered better to get him out and away from the influences that he himself had courted up in the Highlands. He said, I believe you've met Miller. He said, how does he impress you? And we chatted anyway about that. And then one evening, I was in my house in Mombasa, and Miller came to my house. He said, may I talk to you? And he was in a hell of a jittery state. And anyway, I chatted with him for about a couple of hours. Somebody from the inner cabal of Mau Mau had come down to Mombasa and had been talking to him, and I believe had threatened him. Anyway, Miller, at one stage, he burst into tears. And he was in a hell of a state. Anyway, I got rid of him that night, eventually, and
was he asking for police protection?
I think that was brought up, but he didn't want it particularly. He did and he didn't. So finally, we compromised, I think, by having a patrol in the vicinity of his house. Anyway, the following day, I went to Mullins, the commissioner, the provincial commissioner, I told him about this. And he said, I thought so. Mullins was a dour South African with a wonderful sense of humour, and he was a real down-to-earth chap. And he said, there's no doubt we should have to get him out of the colony. He said, I'll speak to the governor. And very, very soon after that, Miller went. Anyway, that's all I know about those two. But it was quite a shaking experience seeing this chap.
Who was this Mau Mau envoy who had been sent to?
I don't know who he was. He wouldn't say.
But he
threatened. In fact, he was talking in shadows the whole time, not wanting to say too much and yet wanting to get something off his chest. And I had quite an evening with him.
So it wasn't a very practical conversation.
Well, it was practical in the sense that he was in the sort of state of nerves which made both me and the provincial commissioner feel that it was he mustn't stay any longer. What happened to him, I don't know.
How on earth had he got into the inner cabal of the
Mamluks? I don't know. He wouldn't. I believe the governor eventually knew, but I never did.
So he wasn't acting as a spy on them?
Oh no. But it was thought that it was as well for Miller's own safety and for security reasons that he was no longer around. I don't know what happened to Miller. I never learned.